It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about the Republican National Convention and what it means for voters with Harry Enten of 538.com.
First, there's a new pathway to casting a ballot for Wisconsinites who don't have a voter ID. U.S. District Judge Lynn Adelman decided in Milwaukee that people without a photo ID can swear to their identity and use an affidavit.
The decision from Adelman will be in effect for the November presidential election, but it won't be in place in time for the primaries for congressional and state legislative races next month. Joining us now to talk more about the decision is Stephen Wright. He's a clinical assistant professor at the Wisconsin Innocence Project at the UW-Madison Law School, and he's a former trial attorney in the voting section of the U.S. Department of Justice. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Well, for what you've seen of this decision, what was Judge Adelman's basis for making it?
Sure. So in 2014, the judge determined that there were approximately 300,000 individuals in the state of Wisconsin who didn't have the required photo ID necessary to vote. The Court of Appeals overturned the decision to invalidate that provision, in short, because the appellate court decided that because 91% of the population, a large amount of percent of the population, actually had the requisite ID, that it was too broad, too big of an idea to get rid of the entire program. The appellate court, however, told the federal court in Milwaukee that it could go back and look at what we can do to help individuals who not only had ID, but who faced insurmountable challenges to get an ID. So these are people who might not have their birth certificates, might not have the requisite things in order to get a photo ID, and that is what this decision was about.
Now, we've seen cases of people having birth certificates with inaccurate information, a typo on it or something. That's been interfering with efforts to get photo ID.
That's right, and that was one of the examples that the court used in its opinion. One of the individuals, a man, was born in Mississippi, but his Mississippi birth certificate had a different spelling of the last name than his Social Security card. And so this individual, the court says, was having a particularly difficult time getting a photo ID and thus could not cast a ballot.
Now, you mentioned that previous ruling from the same judge striking down the whole deal. This is much more narrow than that, it sounds like.
This is much more narrow. The court in that original one expressed the concern about as many as 300,000 voters. In this case, we're talking about a relief that may only impact anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand folks.
So talk us through the process. What would a person in this situation have to do to be able to vote successfully without that ID?
Sure. So to be clear, this ruling doesn't affect individuals who don't want to show a photo ID. This ruling only affects individuals who cannot be reasonably expected to actually obtain a photo ID, which is necessary to vote. So people who may have a very difficult time getting your birth certificate, people who may not have a Social Security card, people who may not have any type of birth records, these people can now sign an affidavit that's been used in other states that simply attests to the fact that it's very difficult for them to get an ID, and they could use that in lieu of a photo ID.
We mentioned this won't be in effect for the primaries coming up next month, but for the big deal in November, it will be in effect. You were mentioning just before we started talking that people may not know about this in time for that.
Right. So one of the things that the plaintiffs, the people who brought this suit, asked the court to do was to order the state of Wisconsin to start a publicity and advertising campaign. The court didn't necessarily believe that was necessary and left it to the state to make sure that people got the word out.
We're talking about a new court ruling allowing a new way to vote for people who have difficulty gaining voter ID here in Wisconsin. We are talking to Steve Wright from the UW-Madison School of Law. He used to be with the Department of Justice working on voting issues. There's been a long legal drama about voter ID here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. I want to point briefly toward two other cases going out. We just heard before airtime today a law in Texas was struck down. As I understand it, this was viewed as one of the more strict voter ID laws in the country. Can you talk about that a bit?
That's right. This was a case out of Texas. It's had a very long procedural history, I think dating all the way back to possibly 2009. The law was originally invalidated under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and it had gone up and through several levels of appellate scrutiny. But then, as you know, the Supreme Court struck down the relevant portions of of the Voting Rights Act. So the litigation had to restart again. And so once again, another federal court, in this time in Texas, determined that this was indeed discriminatory, that it faced, that it forced people to choose between their franchise and, in some cases, spending an entire day missing work. And the court said that was unreasonable. And today, the federal appellate court upheld that decision and setting it up possibly for a Supreme Court review.
Is this something that's close enough to our law here in Wisconsin that we should be paying attention to Texas?
There are, because a lot of what's going on in the courts right now is, especially since the Supreme Court struck down the relevant portions of the Voting Rights Act, the question among lawyers and especially among civil rights lawyers is what might be the rules that the law has established in order to evaluate these? And so different courts are coming up with different tests to see whether indeed that this might be attacked or might be upheld under the new voting rights standards.
And then closer to home, there's another court challenge to Wisconsin's laws, this one not just to voter ID, but to a package of legislation that the plaintiffs say ultimately creates, in effect, an undue burden on specific minority groups. Can you talk about where that one is?
Sure. So that case is being heard in a federal court here in Dane County. That too has been going through several stages of litigation. One of the things that makes that case particularly distinct is there is an outright allegation of it's more than just race or class, that the program was designed to disenfranchise, in this case, Democrats, so that it's also politically motivated and violates the First Amendment. And that case is ongoing.
Let's look at this in constitutional terms. That case bringing the First Amendment on board, I understand the 14th Amendment guaranteeing voting rights has been a factor in a lot of these cases. Can you connect the dots?
Sure. So the 14th Amendment generally ensures protection. Once a state gives people the right to vote, that a state just can't arbitrarily impose a bunch of burdens on it. I think it's also important to note that although many of these cases are brought under the Voting Rights Act, they're also brought sometimes under the 15th Amendment, which was a post-Civil War amendment, ensuring that intentional discrimination against African Americans and minorities was impermissible. And so I think what all of this represents is that because voter ID is something a little bit new, a little bit more in the forefront, the courts are struggling to figure out how do we properly analyze these things, especially given some Supreme Court guidance that voter IDs aren't, or photo IDs in voting aren't automatically impermissible.
This new ruling from Judge Lynn Edelman opens the door to affidavits for people, as we've said, who have difficulty getting a photo ID. The State Department of Justice, Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel, says he was disappointed with the decision. What are his options looking at if he decides he wants to challenge that?
My guess is he's talking right now to the people who actually administer elections and saying what type of burden this would place on them. If they appeal, I would expect an appeal to happen fairly soon. Part of the issue that's going on right now is that this remedy has been ordered for the November election. So the Attorney General is weighing whether he wants to actually be aggressive in ensuring that his rules are applied in the November election or whether the court's safety net will actually be in place.
There's been a lot of back and forth on the voter ID law. It was in effect briefly. There was an injunction during court cases. It was back in. It's been the law of the land for a while. Now there's this change coming, and there's a new board, a new commission administering our elections in Wisconsin. Are you worried about how all of these changes in the courts might affect how people vote on election day?
I'm very worried about that. You know, in my experience, voter confusion happens pretty easily. You know, even when I talk to my students at the law school, they're not always completely certain about what rules are going to apply. Also, it's important to note that confusion often happens with poll workers themselves. People are often trained only once a year. So these type of last-minute rulings, it's not always, you can't always expect bigger jurisdictions, especially like places like Milwaukee, to have trained all their poll workers, literally hundreds, sometimes thousands of people across the state, on these new last-minute rules. And so it creates confusion both among the poll workers as well as the voters.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Stephen Wright. He's a clinical assistant professor at the Wisconsin Innocence Project at UW-Madison's Law School. He's also a former trial attorney in the voting section of the U.S. Department of Justice. Been talking about a new decision from a federal judge giving people without photo ID a way to vote in the November election here in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a group of former inmates are working to improve reentry conditions for people coming out of prison. We'll hear how they help former prisoners fully participate in their communities.
First, we continue our coverage of day two of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland.
Delegates officially named Donald Trump the Republican nominee for president.
Chris Christie gave a rousing speech slamming presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton that riled up the crowds.
Donald Trump's children took the stage at the convention to talk on behalf of their father, while their stepmother Melania is seeing low public approval.
Joining us now to give us the latest update in national politics is Harry Enten. He's a senior political writer and analyst at 538. Harry, welcome back.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, good. Well, let's start with the nomination process and check out what it sounds like as the votes start to come in.
Mr. Chairman, well, you know, we come from the land where we manufacture Pez, nuclear submarines, and the home of the WWE, where men are men and the women are champions. The great state of Connecticut is casting all 28 delegates for the next president of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
So, Harry, we were watching so long for that magic number, 1237, 1,237 delegates. Wasn't even close. So there's no drama going on at this point, right?
Not really much drama. I mean, there were some questions about whether or not they'd be able to get a minority report done, you know, and make the delegates force a real roll call vote. But at the end of the day, Trump ran over the competition, got the 1237 clinched in New York, and it just, the whole thing was over very, very quickly.
So is the whole Never Trump movement, is that officially dead at this point?
It would seem so. I mean, look, there are going to be people who don't end up voting for Trump for sure. But at the end of the day, Donald Trump is the Republican nominee for president. You can cross your T's, dot your I's. He is the candidate for the Republicans.
Now, before we get into some of the speeches that happened last night and what's going on today, how much do these conventions matter, Harry? There's a lot of hoopla, a lot of media coverage. Do they sway voters?
They can sway voters. You know, there's been a dropping sort of effect of the convention bounce. Mitt Romney barely even got one last time around. But at the end of the day, this is a real shot for Donald Trump to be able to take the lead in this race. He's down only a few points now, and we'll see if he's able to do it. If he doesn't take a lead after this convention, then it's pretty much, he's probably not going to be able to win. He needs to be leading after this convention.
Now, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, he spoke at the convention already, and his speech drew a lot of attention for the tone of it. He had a very specific sort of a rhetoric that he was using, getting the crowd chanting. Can you describe that speech for us?
Yeah, I mean, look, Christie is a New Yorker or a New Jerseyan. He is of that New York City metropolitan area, and you could see why he was such an electric speaker. But at the end of the day, you also saw why a lot of New Jerseyans don't like him anymore. He was very rough around the edges. He got the delegates in the hall fired up, but he also may have, in fact, alienated a lot of voters who otherwise might be willing to vote for Trump but aren't quite sure about it.
Let's give a listen to some of Chris Christie's speech here and the response.
In Libya and Nigeria, guilty. In China and Syria, in Iran and Russia and Cuba, and here at home for risking America's secrets to keep her own and lying to cover it all up.
So that was a call and response, part of his prosecutorial effort against Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. And it sounds like the crowd really ran with this, Harry.
I mean, the crowd really ran with it. It was the type of thing that played very well to the delegates in the hall. But again, I'm not sure it's the type of thing that plays with people at home. And that's who even Christie admits is the most important block at this point. The people who are in the hall who were cheering last night are people who were already voting for Donald Trump. And there were very few people in the hall compared to the number of voters who were voting in November. So we'll see if that type of thing that he did last night translates. I think it was a little rough. I thought that there were other speeches last night that were a little bit better, but we'll see.
So, Harry, based on what you've heard so far, Chris Christie just being one example, are you hearing people make a strong case to vote for Donald Trump, or are you hearing don't vote for Hillary Clinton?
That's been one of the most interesting things about this so far, is almost all of the speakers have spoken out about why you shouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton. Very few have said why you should vote for Donald Trump. And I think that is a real question going forward, is even if people don't want to vote for Clinton, can they pull the trigger and vote for Donald Trump. And so far, we've seen in most of the polls that Trump has struggled to get above 40%. And I'm not necessarily sure that the past few days have convinced them to get enough so that they will, Trump's numbers can move above 40%. It could be the case, though, that Hillary Clinton's numbers fall even further, and maybe a Libertarian candidate like Gary Johnson ends up picking up a lot of that, and you end up with an election that's 40-40-20 or something along those lines. Who knows?
Before we move on from that anti-Clinton theme, I want to listen to a bit of a former presidential candidate now, Ben Carson's speech. Here he's drawing attention to, he says, Hillary Clinton's role model, organizer Saul Alinsky. Here's a listen.
This is a nation where every coin in our pocket and every bill in our wallet says, in God we trust. So are we willing to elect someone as president who has as their role model somebody who acknowledges Lucifer? Think about that.
So Saul Alinsky and a list of people who had, I guess, inspired his type of activism included Lucifer in that list. So 2 degrees of separation there, I guess Ben Carson is saying.
You know, I think that most people don't even know who Saul Alinsky is. I think most people know who Lucifer is, but I don't necessarily think that that's, again, not the type of thing that plays with people in the mainstream. This is not the type of thing that plays with people in the mainstream, and I think that there's a real question about whether this convention really talks to people in middle America, whether it talks to people who are in the center of the aisle, and we'll see if Trump is able to get a convention bounce out of this. I'm not so sure he will, but then again, this year's been so crazy that maybe he'll get a 6 or 7 point bounce.
We're talking to Harry Enten right now from 538. He's at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. And Harry, Donald Trump's family has been taking the stage as well. We heard from a son of his last night, also from daughter Ivanka Trump. But the person, the speaker getting the most headlines was his wife, Melania Trump, would-be first lady. Tell us about the reaction there at the convention and what happened after.
Well, you know, the Trump family, there have been a number of speeches that have been given. The Melania Trump speech was one that I don't think, you know, a lot of delegates in the hall were loving too much. And then there was obviously the whole problem with Melania Trump and the plagiarism allegations that she copied part of her speech from Michelle Obama's speech in 2008 when she was speaking at the Democratic National Convention. But the two Trump children who spoke on Tuesday were much better received, especially Donald Trump Jr., who a lot of people who were never Trumpers on my Twitter feed were saying, man, they wish that Donald Trump Jr. was, in fact, the Republican nominee for president, not Donald Trump Sr.
We'll look at the kids more in a minute, but before we move on from Melania Trump, you wrote a piece looking at, and I didn't know people polled on this, potential first lady approval numbers, and she is not doing well compared to first ladies, spouses of candidates in the past. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, sure. So it turns out when you look at the numbers going back to 1988, they ask, you know, do you have a favorable or unfavorable view of so-and-so? And they ask it for, they've asked it at least since 1988 for all the potential spouses of presidential candidates, presidential nominees. And when you look at Melania Trump's numbers from Gallup just this past week, more people disliked her than liked her. That is very unusual. Usually spouses are much more popular than the candidates themselves. And usually more people like the spouses than dislike the spouses. In fact, Trump is the least liked spouse at this point going back since at least 1992. And if her numbers hold through the end of the campaign, she would be the least liked candidate since at least 1988.
So does that matter, though, numbers like that? I mean, we talk about do vice presidents matter, but on a different level, one generation removed. What about the spouses?
I don't think it matters very much, to be honest. I mean, look, Hillary Clinton was one of the least liked spouses of all time when she was Bill Clinton was winning election and re-election in 1992 and 1996. And Bill Clinton was easily able to win despite the fact that Barbara Bush and Liz Dahl were far more popular than Hillary Clinton was. So, no, I don't think it's something that will really play or really will matter. Donald Trump will win this or lose this on his own. But at the end of the day, I don't think anyone wants to be disliked. And unfortunately for Melania Trump, the American public isn't in love with her at this point.
Well, Harry, you mentioned the children of Donald Trump speaking. Let's give a listen. We'll hear first Tiffany and then Donald Jr.
If you do what you love, hold nothing back, and never let fear of failure get in the way, then you pretty much figured out the Trump formula.
His true gift as a leader is that he sees the potential in people that they don't even see in themselves. The potential that other executives would overlook because their resumes don't include the names of fancy colleges and degrees.
So there was a case where you're hearing people talking more pro-Donald Trump than anti-Hillary Clinton, and the idea that, hey, maybe his kids can put, you know, humanize him a little, as every presidential candidate kind of wants to be. Will that have an impact?
Well, I think it does. I mean, that's part of what a convention is supposed to do. It's supposed to humanize the candidate. And that's why I think the 2012 Republican convention wasn't as good for Mitt Romney as it could have been, because instead of having a video playing that showed Mitt Romney doing, you know, being a nice guy, they instead had Clint Eastwood on the stage talking to an empty chair. And so I think that speeches like the ones that Donald Trump and Tiffany Trump gave are the types of things that certainly help candidates out. It helps humanize them. I'm not sure we can put a number on it. I think it's something that really is taken as a package. But I think both Tiffany Trump and especially Donald Trump Jr. last night certainly didn't hurt their father and probably helped him.
And Harry, I know it's only Wednesday and we have to wait a little bit till Donald Trump himself takes the stage. But as we wrap up here, what does he have to do, do you think, during his big speech that's going to give him that bump in the polls that you're looking for to see if it happens and maybe close the deal here?
I think what you're really looking for at the end of the day is for Donald Trump to make the case not just why Hillary Clinton is unprepared to be commander-in-chief, but why Donald Trump is prepared to be commander-in-chief. He has to make the American people feel comfortable with choosing him, because no matter how much they hate Hillary Clinton, if he doesn't provide a legitimate alternative, then he's just simply not going to be able to get votes in the middle of the aisle, and he's going to continue to be stuck at around 40% of the vote.
We'll leave it there, Harry. Thanks a lot, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. He joins us every week to talk about national politics. He's covering the Republican National Convention in Cleveland.
Coming up after the news, we talk with a former inmate whose group is working to improve treatment of former prisoners and help them become contributing members of society. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland to share the latest news from the Wisconsin delegation.
First, former inmates face a difficult transition after leaving jail or prison. Even though they've served out their punishment, ex-prisoners experience discrimination on many levels, have trouble finding a job or housing. Those things can be particularly difficult.
A group of former inmates are working to improve conditions for ex-prisoners and help them fully participate in their communities. Their aim is to see former prisoners become valued members of society.
With us now is Frank Davis. He's assistant organizer for the group Ex-Prisoners Organizing, or EXPO. That's a group of formerly incarcerated people who are working to improve treatment of former prisoners. EXPO is a project of the faith-based organization Wisdom. Frank, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Well, you've been through this, as I understand it, Frank, yourself, serving time in prison. What were some of the biggest barriers for you returning to life outside of prison?
Well, for me, I was incarcerated when I was 18. And when I got out at the age of 37, the whole world changed. The internet was new, cell phones, Androids, everything was new. Cars starting on their own, and everything was new. So for me, just the basic thing of learning the city, learning how to ride a bus, learning how to write just an application. And there were a lot of things that you don't know about because you're in this confined space, even just communicating with people.
I never knew, heard, thought about it that way. You're a time traveler in a way.
Exactly. Exactly. I remember the first time I got on a bus, and it was one of these energy assistant buses, and it actually dropped down when I got on it, and it, you know, it freaked me out. It was totally different. Even how you put the money in it, it was totally different. So for me, it was it was sort of like time warp, because I came out and I didn't know a lot that was going on. However, because of the person that I chose to become, I came out with a mentality that regardless what it is, I refuse to allow it to stumble me or to allow me to allow it to frustrate me. So I took it as a challenge, and I was like, I'm not going to allow it to hold me back.
Now, another sort of identity issue before we get to some of the practical hurdles, I understand just figuring out who you are, because a lot of people, the 18-year-old who didn't go to prison and they're 37 now, they've had 19 years living not in prison, fitting into society, knowing kind of their place in it. How does somebody coming out of prison and jail try to figure out how they fit in?
And that is the one of the hardest things to do. A lot of individuals, when they're in there, they're surrounded. They don't have a support system. So when you're in prison, you have a lot of times a negative mentality around you. You have officers and guards that are in there, and a lot of times their first priority isn't about trying to be your friend or trying to educate you or trying to help you acclimate to society. Their job is strictly about trying to keep you in there, and some of them have a mentality of punishment. So the rest of the individuals in there, it's a negative environment. And that negative environment, back when I was doing time, they college program, school program, it was basic. Trying to teach you how to have skills for a job, they weren't there. So the basic jobs that you received in prison, they weren't transferable skills out here in the world. So it's frustrating for a lot of guys. And the other part is that a lot of guys don't know. So if you only know what you know, then you get out, and when other people are telling you, you need to do more, you need to have a wider variety of ideas and a scope of thinking, for them, it's horrifying, because a lot of times you're telling them that their principles are wrong. And anytime you tell a person that their principles are wrong and their foundation is screwed up, it's a confrontation there. And that is the thing that we at Expo, we try to do. We try to get in and help people so they don't have that frustrating transition point.
How does that work? So does that mean somebody like you who's been through this already ends up being a mentor for somebody who's just getting out, I don't know, maybe tomorrow?
Well, it's some of that, but it's also we give them examples. A lot of times guys get out, they come to a group, and there are a couple different groups that we're associated with that will have support group, so to speak. And what we do, we would give them information. A lot of us, sometimes it's just one-on-one. They have other groups where we would go there and they're sitting there and we'd talk to them. We'd pull them out to the side. What are you doing? You got a job? Do you have a place to stay? And a lot of times they don't. And what we try to do, we try to give them information. A lot of us, we've been here. We know that there are certain places that they would give you a chance. There are some jobs that would give you an opportunity to prove yourself. Some apartment complexes that they will rent to you. There are a whole lot of them that won't. But because we've been here and we've done it, and we walked in their shoes, we can give them a little perspective of what they can expect and who they can contact, and that alleviates some of the pressure and frustration.
Talking to Frank Davis with the group Ex-Prisoners Organizing, or EXPO, a group of formerly incarcerated people here in Wisconsin trying to improve life, treatment for former prisoners, help them make that transition out of prison into their community. What we focused on so far is kind of focused on the former inmates themselves. You're also trying to change attitudes for people toward those former inmates. You mentioned the negative attitude in prison. One thing I know you work on is the attitudes of potential employers, of potential landlords, to try to make it so that there are more places that would give a chance to former inmates.
Yes, we do. And that is one of the hardest things. A lot of time people don't want to change their attitude. And it's not because they're closed off or they're just hateful people. Sometimes it's because they either been victimized in the past or they don't know anyone. So they look at someone getting out of prison as a monster, a beast, somebody that whole NIMBY attitude where, you know, they don't want them living in their community in their backyard next to them. And they look at them for either their crime or something that the media or somebody on TV tells them that because he committed a murder or rape or burglary or something like this, that he doesn't deserve a second chance, or if he does, you know, put him over there where can't nobody see him. And we try to give them this examples of people that I've been in prison. However, I'm not what I did, and I'm not who I was. So if everybody wants a chance to change and say, I'm sorry, give me a second chance, why shouldn't the individuals getting out of prison, getting out of jails, get the same thing?
That's an attitude adjustment. You're also looking for specific legal changes, policy changes, things like the Ban the Box campaign. Can you talk about that?
Well, the Ban the Box campaign, it was one of the things that we really wanted because with that little check mark box on an application, there were a lot of times where you put that check mark, I have a felony, or I have a felony on my record, misdemeanor, I've been in prison. A lot of times, employers would just throw it in the trash. I remember there was just one story. This woman said that she went, put in an application, the check mark was on there. She checked the box. She put it in. She came out, went to her car, and she forgot something on the application. So she walked back in so she can actually put this on the application. And she said the woman reached over and pulled her application out the trash can. Now, that right there, just because it was only because the checkbox. Now, right there, she didn't get an opportunity to prove that she had changed, that she was qualified. She didn't get an opportunity to even come to the table of an interview. And that's what we fight for, to get that off, to basically say, allow a person to get through that first step process, then allow them to discuss it with their employer. And that would actually give some fairness to individuals trying to get a job. And it's very important.
Another concern is people being sent back to prison because of things like parole violations, even if they haven't committed a new crime. Mm-hmm. What's happening in Wisconsin?
Well, those are what we call crimeless revocations. And the crimeless revocations is one of the things that draws a lot of money. There are literally about 4,000 people a year that go back to prison off of crimeless revocation. Crimeless revocations are an example of a person getting... for rules of revocation, you have rules that you have to abide by. There are certain rules. Individuals say you can't have a cell phone. You can't have a laptop. You can't cross this county line. You can't buy a car without your agent's permission. And there were times where individuals actually get locked up, sent back to prison for multiple years, not because they threatened no one, not because they weren't having a job or didn't have a place to stay, only because they chose to have a laptop. Not that they were doing anything illegal on that laptop, but because they chose to break this one rule, then they were getting sent back to prison. And our stance is that there should be alternatives. There should be viable alternatives for an individual breaking rules. So if it's a crimeless revocation, why should this individual get sent to prison? We're talking about over $150 million a year for individuals going back to prison for crimeless revocations. And when you send a person back to prison for a crimeless revocation, a lot of times they lose their job, they lose their home. A lot of these people, they have kids, so the kids lose out for it. And when they go in, it doesn't protect the community. How does it protect the community if a person had a cell phone, if he had a laptop, or if he bought a car without permission? Okay, he should have followed his rules. However, to send them back to prison, our stance is that that is extreme and there needs to be a different stance. So we are behind different ways to actually come up with different ideas to help them out. So give them alternatives.
We're talking about the barriers former inmates face when they return to society and what a group of ex-prisoners is doing to try to help them fully reintegrate into their communities.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Are you a former inmate? What were the biggest obstacles for you? How do you feel about former prisoners returning to your community? And what do you think people can do to help prisoners adapt back into society? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Frank Davis stays with us. He's assistant organizer for the Madison chapter of EXPO. That's a group of formerly incarcerated people who aim to restore former inmates to full participation in their communities. More coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our conversation about the difficulties former inmates can face when they return to society after serving their time. A group of ex-prisoners are working to help overcome reentry barriers and discrimination against former prisoners.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Are you a former inmate trying to adapt back to life in society? What hurdles are you facing? Or if it's not you, would you, if you're an employer, hire someone who had been in prison? Would you rent an apartment to someone who'd been in prison? Would you welcome them into your community? Call 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Frank Davis is with us, assistant organizer for the Madison chapter of EXPO, an organization that works to improve treatment of former prisoners. Frank, the chapters here in Wisconsin and Madison, Milwaukee have had public forums over the last couple of weeks. What kinds of things are you hearing there?
Well, our forum was last Thursday here in Madison, and then there was one in Milwaukee. And basically what we wanted to do, we wanted to come out and introduce our tip to the community and let them know that who we are, what we're doing, and why we exist. And it was a good turnout. It was a good turnout, and we received a lot of good response from the people. People were actually concerned. Family members, they want to know that that there's going to be help. There, one woman, her husband has been in prison for almost 30 years. I want to say 26, 27 years. And he is under old law. And technically, he should have been out. However, because this new system of truth and sentence, they fundamentally have basically thrown the parole system away. They still have individual parole commissioners who go around, but they won't let them out. And this is one of the concerns that come up when we have these forums or when we talk. People want to know that there's somebody out here, there's an entity that's going to help them and help their family members. So that's what we heard from the community, and that's what we're focusing on, strictly trying to give individuals in prison a voice and give individuals coming out power. Power that they know that when they come out, there's a support system to help them. And the support system isn't a fly-by-night support system that they're just going to come out here and word and don't do anything to help them. We're actually here. We've been there. We walk the walk, and we're talking the talk, and this is very necessary. It is very necessary.
Let's bring in our callers now at 800-642-1234. Judy is on the line in Baraboo. Judy, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm reading the book Orange is the New Black, which is completely different than the Netflix. But my question is, she was saying, and she really talks deeply about how there is no support for them when they come out. And is there anything as a citizen that I can do that would encourage something, you know, to find jobs and find apartments? Is there anything we can do in that area to help?
Judy, thanks for the call. So what's out there right now for people coming out of prison, and what could she as a everyday citizen do to help provide something like that?
Thank you for the call, Judy. One of the things to do is contact some of the, or you got EXPO. We're connected to Wisdom. And a lot of the things we do, we can get you in contact with local organizations or organizations which are close to you that actually help. EXPO has been around for a couple of years. It first came about in 2014. So EXPO is somewhat new, but we're connected to the Gamaliel organization, which has been around for a while. So the connections that we have and the information that we have is extensive. So if you want to get in contact with Wisdom, wisdom.org, and go there, you can get a lot of the information. And one of the other things that reentry, it is a hard thing to actually fight for, to get funding, because for the longest there was this hard on crime, tough on crime mentality. And now the pendulum is swinging over to the other side. And so a lot of individuals and a lot of people know that this is important. So we're actually getting a lot of reentry programs going, trying to help individuals out, getting them to connect it with mentorship, getting them with job training, and even getting them with where when they come out, there's a list of places that would actually rent to them. So we have that easily accessible to our organization.
Talking to Frank Davis with the group Expo, talking about former prison inmates, their readjustment to society. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Thanks to Judy for that call. We'll go now to Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi. Hi. I just wanted to talk to your guest about that. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and is he aware, I think he probably is, that he knows the Department of Community Corrections in Wisconsin, other people who revoke people. There are studies based on their records and one by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee that proves objectively that crimeless revocations, meaning sending people back to prison for things other than committing crimes, are disproportionately brought against people of color in the state of Wisconsin, particularly in the Milwaukee-Racine community. And I just wanted to contribute that and get your guest response. Thank you.
Jim, thanks. Frank?
Well, that is true. Thank you for the call, Jim. Black men, as we know, are 5% of the adult male population in Wisconsin. However, we constitute 39% of all crimeless revocations. Well, that was the stats from 2014. So that was 12 times the amount and number of white males in the state of Wisconsin. And then another factor is that crimeless revocations has been one of the primary reasons, the highest number, for black males actually returning to prison. So when you look at the black male population in Wisconsin prisons, the majority of them are in there. Or I should say, not the majority, but a high number, almost half, are in there because of crimeless revocations. That is absurd, because when you do that, you get frustrated people, you get a waste of dollars, a waste of money. A lot of these individuals, if they have a drug treatment, if you lock somebody up for having a dirty UA because they smoked some pot or, you know, did some cocaine or got drunk, how is that really helping them out when you put them in prison? And a lot of times you need basically treatment alternatives or alternatives to prison. And so, yeah, Jim is correct. That is, it disproportionately affects minorities and black men in the state, and it is a total waste of money.
Jim, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Ken in Wisconsin Rapids. Ken, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I haven't been in the penitentiary system since 2004, but the system is really sickening, because it is a money thing. Just it's a farming. They just farm the guys. They don't care about the inmates. And when I was in, I sat here. And when I got out, I got revoked for I got charged on a false charge, and they still revoked me because they dismissed everything because it was wrong. And the person said that they said they lied, and I still went to the penitentiary for a year and a half.
Ken, got it. We're limited on time here, Frank, but he is saying really nothing going on good in the prison system that was going to help him when he got out, and too easy, he thought, to get revoked.
And it is. Sometimes it truly is. I know that, and that is one of the frustrating parts, where an individual will call a parole agent, will say that so-and-so beat me up, threatened me, or whatever. Then when it comes to find out that the person lied, the person would still wind up go to prison and get revoked. And that is something needs to change about that.
Frank, as we wrap up, how important is it for ex-inmates, ex-prisoners like yourself to be part of the solution to the problems you're bringing up?
It's necessary. For the simple fact, how can you ask somebody to give you an idea on a landscape if they haven't been in that arena? We, as ex-prisoners, are probably the best type of professional that can actually help, because we've been there. We know the frustrations. We know the pitfalls. We know the things that we have to, the anxieties that we have to come out to. We know how it feels not to have that support system. So we can actually help change and tweak a lot of programs out here for returning prisoners, because we know it. So when it comes to training them, teaching them, we can say, okay, well, this helps, this affects, and this would be better to do.
Very briefly, are people listening, policymakers, decision makers? I know it's a new organization. Are you being heard?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. There has been a lot of interest. We have sat down with many different aldermen and legislators to talk, and Like I said, the pendulum is changing. And as it changed, as we inform people, there's like this paradigm shift in a lot of people's psyche, and they understand, okay, this has to change. We can't keep going down the same road.
Frank, thanks a lot for joining us here in the studio today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Frank Davis. He's an assistant organizer for the Madison chapter of the group EXPO. That's an organization that works to improve treatment of former prisoners, and it consists of former prisoners themselves. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your experiences, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Movie and TV legend Gary Marshall passed away at the age of 81 yesterday, and his long career had two big Wisconsin connections.
Marshall was the creator of the TV shows Happy Days and the spinoff Laverne and Shirley, both set here in Wisconsin, though not always filmed here in Wisconsin. But for a lot of people around the country, I think those two shows might be the only thing they know about Wisconsin.
Well, and as if that's not enough, he was also involved in shows like Mork and Mindy with Robin Williams, The Odd Couple, The Dick Van Dyke Show, and a lot more. And he directed movies, too, including the movies Beaches, Pretty Woman, and The Princess Diaries.
That's amazing, I think, how much, when you think of Milwaukee, they've got the Fonzie statue there.
The Bronze Fonz,
uh-huh. Exactly. Happy Days, I think, set a lot of people's imaginations of sort of mid-American life and what Wisconsin was. And Laverne and Shirley, of course, has the opening theme song that mentions Milwaukee. Do you have a favorite character or moment?
I always identify, I shouldn't say this on the radio, I identify a lot with Laverne. I feel like I have an inner Laverne. That's kind of me. And you're obviously
I'd want to say Fonz. I'm probably Ralph Malph in real life. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. Rocking and rolling all week long.
Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday.